supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
In part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Gratitude. That's a nice concept, but it's difficult to achieve, especially during the holiday season when pressure's on to buy the right gift, serve the right food, maybe even be nice to people you don't like. So you could argue that with all the stress of the season compounded by a deteriorating economy that worries us all, what is there to be thankful about? Well, according to my guest, Robert Emmons, plenty. He argues that this business of gratitude not only makes us happier, but it's a state of mind that can be changed regardless of our external circumstances. Robert Emmons is a professor of psychology at UC Davis. He's the author of several books and articles too numerous to count, but his most recent books are Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happy, as well as The Psychology of Gratitude. Robert Emmons, thanks for joining us.
Welcome, Dan. Thank you.
We'd like to hear your stories of gratitude. Our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Not just what you're grateful for, but I also want to hear from those who have difficulty with gratitude and feel there's nothing to be grateful for. So, you know, if you're happy and grateful, give us a call. But if you're cranky and a little bit depressed and kind of PO'd at the world, we want to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Robert, your research and your books fall under the category of positive psychology, fathered by our local Martin Seligman. But more specifically, it's happiness research. So there's a lot of emotions that come under the umbrella of happiness, including faith, forgiveness, and gratitude, probably others. What's the difference between the three? What do they have in common? How are they different?
Well, you're right. At one level, there certainly is a commonality that they all involve developing positive feelings or pleasant feelings. The way I like to think about it is gratitude is happiness plus something. It's happiness plus a recognition that we have people to thank. We have powers outside of ourselves that are partly responsible for providing us with benefits. I think of gratitude really as a form of thoughtfulness. In fact, you can often link, and people have done this throughout the years, link the words thinking and thanking. So to be thankful is really to be thoughtful, because we look around, we look at our lives, and we see that there are other people that are partly responsible for our well-being. They've come before us, they've paved the way for us, and we acknowledge the contributions they've made. So it's dwelling upon the goodness that we've been given. So one can think about happiness as dwelling upon goodness, finding things in one's life to be happy about. But gratitude goes beyond that, because it's a deeper recognition that other people or other forces, perhaps God, other moral agents or beings, are responsible for these good things.
This brings up your words of non-gratitude versus ingratitude. What's the difference?
So when we're not grateful, there's basically two options. You know, to think about the opposite of gratitude or giving thanks. What does it look like to be a person who is not grateful? And generally speaking, majority of the time, we're simply forgetful. We forget to remember. You know, gratitude involves remembering to remember all those things that we have as benefits. And when we are not grateful, we may just be forgetful. We may be distracted by the busyness of everyday life. We may overlook how other people have helped us in the past. And so generally, we're talking about a condition of non-gratitude. Ingratitude, on the other hand, is a deliberate attempt basically to be nasty to people who have helped us, when we deliberately tend to ignore the benefits others have provided for us. Or we discount the gift. We say they were just doing this to feel better about themselves. We attribute other motives to their benevolent behavior. So ingratitude really is responding with either indifference or downright unpleasantness in response to someone else's goodness. And I think that's rather unusual state. More typical is a state of non-gratitude.
We do, though, have problem-solving brains, so that we tend to look at problems for problems, and that's the way our brains work. We don't automatically look towards things we are grateful for.
We don't, but the grateful person also has a tendency toward hopefulness or optimism in the future. So a grateful person could look at the problems and believe that there are solutions to be found. They wouldn't become so perhaps overwhelmed by the nature of the problem itself. They would look beyond that to the solution, whether they believed they themselves had the wherewithal to bring about a solution or they believed eventually that solutions can be found. I think the grateful people have a way of transcending the problem to focus on a more adaptive response or solution to those problems. But I think you're right that the tendency does not come easily or naturally to most people.
Which sets up the next question, which is your work with people and gratitude. Your research project had people do gratitude exercises. So gratitude can be learned?
Well, I was interested very early in determining just that answer to that question. Can you actually practice gratitude on a regular basis? Do people find it possible to immerse themselves in an outlook on life by which they focus more on benefits, on blessings, on gifts that they've been given? And if so, if people can actually consciously do this through very simple techniques such as keeping a gratitude journal, does this have an impact on them? Can this move their emotions, for instance? Can this change their relationships, the quality and perception of how they're relating to other people? Can there actually be physical consequences to cultivating gratitude? So we asked all these questions when we began to see if there really was a power to gratefulness, as has been suggested throughout centuries by non-scientists. We wanted to put some of these ideas to the scientific test.
And?
Well, we did find, in fact, that there were significant benefits to keeping a gratitude journal, to developing gratitude. Primarily in three domains, we found psychologically, people felt better. They became more open to life. They reported higher levels of enthusiasm, attentiveness, alertness, engagement with life. So this tended to open them up in a very psychological, substantial, emotional way.
You also found that they had more energy and slept better.
They slept better. So that one of the most surprising categories of benefits we found were the physical. It wasn't that surprised that there were some psychological benefits. After all, we would expect that if you focus and make your mind dwell on the positives, it would affect your thoughts and your feelings. But physically, we found that people slept better. They slept longer. They woke up. They felt more refreshed. They had fewer awakenings during the night. So there was some beneficial effects on sleep quality and duration, which we know is very important for overall physical well-being. People exercised more. They actually spent more time in physical exercise when they were keeping gratitude journals. And since those initial studies, we found some other important findings, too. For instance, that gratitude can actually reduce blood pressure. That was a finding that came out of a laboratory, actually, in Philadelphia, that found that when people were keeping gratitude journals, their blood pressure went down by an average of 10%. So some exciting findings suggesting that gratitude improves physical health as well as psychological health.
You know, I'm involved with the Penn Program for Stress Management, which uses a mindfulness-based approach. And they have a very similar exercise where people are asked to keep journals 1 week about what brings them joy when they experience joy moment by moment, just to notice when they experience joy and write it down. And the next week, they're asked to note when they are experiencing the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, it sounds. I mean, this of course is training mindfulness, training the mind to be awake and alert moment by moment. When you talked about non-gratitude, it's almost like not being mindful of your life. And the journaling sounds like it's an almost an exercise in mindfulness.
I think it is. I think there's a very close connection there. There's certainly a parallel, because gratitude does require first becoming awake, right? Becoming alert and attentive and noticing. But also, it's making decisions. It's recognizing where good things come from. I think it goes a little bit beyond keeping a list of what one is happy about or what brings one joy. I think it's acknowledgement. There's an appreciation of something good received from another person. So it focuses our attention outward. It might begin with an inward reflection and awareness, but enables us to move beyond self-focus to an engagement beyond the self that I think ultimately is one of the more powerful mechanisms by which gratitude basically works, because it connects us deeply to others.
We're talking with Robert Emmons, who's a professor at UC Davis. He's an expert on gratitude. So if you want to join our conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We want to hear from you if you're grateful or if you have difficulty feeling gratitude, or the other extreme, if you're cranky or just know someone who's cranky. We want to hear from you. Robert, you talked about a set point for gratitude, just like there's one for weight, and there's a set point for happiness, too. I want to tell you, I trust the truth of that, but as a garden variety clinician, my first piece of work is getting people comfortable with who they are and where they are, including their various set points. Is that part of your work, too, or is your work about changing the set point?
Well, I think part of it depends upon the direction people want to move, of course. What we find is that there are certainly differences in tendency to be grateful, and so we can identify people who are more grateful than less grateful, and certainly the ones who score below average, they may find that there are some advantages to that. It may help them make various decisions, it may help them be analytical in certain contexts. So my work is more experimental-based, it's more research-based, and people don't come to me as they would come to you, you know, trying to change an aspect of themselves. But we do find that when people do keep gratitude journals, they do see the benefits. They continue to want to develop and deepen their gratefulness because they see that it affects a number of realms of their lives beyond mood, beyond feeling better, feeling less distressed. They see that it makes their relationships stronger. They feel closer, more connected to others. They feel less lonely.
Which reinforces itself. So are you suggesting a set point can be changed?
I believe so. I mean, I'm pretty realistic. I don't think you can, you know, necessarily change, you know, a grump into someone who is ecstatic 100% of the time. I think of set point more as a range. You know, I think that's consistent with a lot of the research as well. There's a range there, and you can move around within a range. So you perhaps may not be able to go from a minus 9 to a plus 9, let's say, and a minus 10 to a plus 10. But if, you know, if you inherit a range, let's say, of a 1 to a 5, that's your potential. You could move from a 1 up to a 5, perhaps by some sort of intensive training through mindfulness that can cultivate a sense of gratefulness, or some of the other techniques that I'm sure you use in your work.
Right. Let's see if we can squeeze a phone call in before our break. We've got Karen on the line. Karen, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I can barely hear you. Can you hear me?
I can hear you very well.
Okay. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a life coach, and I really enjoy this whole area, and I use gratitude to help clients tap into a better outlook and overcome obstacles. My comment or question connects to what you were talking about with mindfulness, and I think that gratitude is easier to engage in when we're not in a rush. And I think that's one of the things I appreciate, Dan, in your voice. You have a very easy, slow pace to your voice, and I think it helps with engaging in mindfulness, and I think it's much easier to be grateful when we're not rushing around.
Well, I do have a slow, easy-paced voice, but you ought to meet my mind one day. Never mind. Well, that's not a good idea. You've, Robert, said that it is easy to be grateful when we have nice things going on around us, and life is pretty calm. It's hard to be grateful when we're under stress.
Well, I used to think that, and part of me still thinks that's true for many people. But, the other side of that story is that when life is going swimmingly, perhaps we're more likely to take things for granted, or we tend to take credit for these successes. We feel pride in these sorts of situations when we are successful at work or in athletic competition or in relationships. And it's only adversity, sometimes loss, crisis, that drives us to go a bit deeper, that forces us to realize how dependent we are upon other people. And for many people in life, it's adversity that deepens and sharpens their gratefulness, and it becomes an approach to life that's really essential in these conditions. So I'm not so sure. I might be revising my position on when it's possible or when it's easier to feel grateful. I think it depends really on the individual and other qualities that they may have.
See, Karen, my reaction to you and the people you coach is that it's difficult to find gratitude when you're racing around like that. It's important to know that you're suffering when you race around like that. That there's your heart is closed, your body's tense, there's cortisol in your vein. And, I've cited before, there's research, Candace Pert's doing research, that suggests we actually get addicted to those chemicals that get dumped in our veins by the predominant emotion, whether it's adrenaline or cortisol. So we tend to do stuff that reinforces that over and over again. The first step, before I even would send your clients to Robert or one of his disciples, is just to stop and breathe and feel how much pain your body is in. You can do that in a matter of 30 seconds several times a day.
Yes. The benefits of slowing down.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more with Robert Emmons about gratitude. And we'll take more of your calls. Robert Emmons is a professor of psychology at UC Davis. He's written Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happier, as well as The Psychology of Gratitude and Words of Gratitude for Mind, Body, and Soul. Our number is 888-477-9499, and we'll be back in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
YY and your efforts to stay healthy. ChristianaCare's Helen F. Graham Cancer Center is one of only 14 in the country selected by the National Cancer Institute as a community cancer center program. Patients are offered a team of medical experts backed up by the latest research trials, technology, and a personal care coordinator who guides them every step of the way. More information online at christianacare.org/cancer.
Hi, I'm Scott Simon from NPR News. It was only through talking to my mother and listening once that I found out she worked in summer stock theater with Grace Kelly. You might learn some surprising facts about your family, too, on the National Day of Listening, the day after Thanksgiving. Make some time while the family's gathered for the holidays to ask questions and to listen. Who knows what you might learn? You can find out more at nationaldayoflistening.org.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about gratitude with Robert Emmons, who's a professor of psychology at UC Davis and an expert on gratitude and happiness. Robert, I want to talk about how difficult it is for some people to experience gratitude after a loss or after a trauma. Isn't that asking a lot?
I think it is. I think sometimes we want to rush through things and want to go in and fix, or we are well-intentioned friends, such as Job's friends in the Old Testament, who say, Job, cheer up. You You know, what did you do to bring the situation upon yourself? And, of course, such sentiments are far from supportive. In fact, are can be quite destructive. So, you know, one thing I've been thinking about recently, though, is the difference between gratefulness as a feeling and gratefulness as an attitude. And we certainly don't feel grateful when loss happens. We don't feel thankful that we've lost a home, that we can't pay our mortgage, that we've lost our job, that we have a child with a serious diagnosis. But can we summon up some gratefulness for life in spite of these things that are happening to us? And I think if, you know, it of course may be difficult for a person to make fine distinctions between attitudes and feelings during these circumstances, but I think that's a distinction that could be beneficial. Takes a little pressure off in this desire we have to be happy, to be positive, no matter what the circumstances are.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Rick on the line. Hi, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. What can we do for you?
Okay. I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 years, and when I went in, I was an atheist, but with doubts. AA teaches that an attitude of gratitude is very important, and that coming to believe in a higher power is also very important. And I tried that for 19 years, and after 19 years, I admit that I haven't been able to accept a higher power or believe in one, and I admit that I'm an atheist, and I'm comfortable with it, and I have no doubts, and I don't feel naughty or guilty the way I used to about it. And I've admitted it at meetings, and that this is the first Thanksgiving where I have admitted this out loud to myself and to other people and accept it. And I'm finding that gratitude is different when there's no object for it. Some people will say I'm so grateful to be sober. My higher power made me sober. I say grace at meals. I can't thank a higher power for my meal when there are people starving. I don't want to make this into a discussion of whether a God exists, but the fact that when we talk about gratitude, we're talking about, in general, I think, gratitude to a God or higher power. And without that, my gratitude is kind of free-floating, free form, if you will, and with no object to it. And it feels strange.
Mm-hmm. Feels strange. That's an interesting word. I want to... You're opening up a really interesting area about the role of faith in gratitude and happiness and gratitude for or gratitude of. I just before we turn to Robert, just one observation about what happens at the beginning of meals. Before I eat a meal, when I am mindful, I am grateful for all of the hundreds of people and maybe animals that are responsible for putting those meals on my table for me. So you can feel grateful whether there's a higher power or not. Robert, I'd like to hear your reaction to all of these interesting issues that Rick brings up. You've talked a great deal about the importance of faith, and does it have to be faith in a higher power?
Well, certainly virtually every religion around the world throughout history has emphasized gratefulness or thanksgiving. It's, you know, part of the ethical foundation of world religions, first of all, which state that people are morally obligated to give thanks to each other and to their God. Now, I would stress both of those components, though, to each other and to God. So gratitude is really a dual quality, that it involves everyday interpersonal transactions between people. Much of everyday life is about giving and receiving of benefits and repaying of these benefits. And so I'm sure even though the caller may have difficulty in expressing gratitude to a God, and in fact, if one does not believe in the God, it does not make sense at all. It's illogical to give thanks to someone you don't believe in. But certainly there's other people who have influenced him who have come to become important persons in his life that are responsible for getting to him where he is right now. And so there's that element of gratitude that is the interpersonal transaction, the receiving of benefits from others. But there is the transcendent component as well that many people around the world from the beginning of time have acknowledged, and I think that, you know, adds an additional element to gratitude. Certainly people can be grateful without believing in a higher power, just as people can be forgiving or hopeful or joyful or any other emotion that we typically think about in terms of the sacred without having a particular sacred or spiritual orientation in their lives.
Albert Schweitzer said, "At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us." And many times we don't know those people. We're not conscious of those people. So there's a position of gratitude, carrying that around.
It really is a stance, I think. You're right. It's an orientation toward others and toward the world. It's a posture that, you know, some might describe this as a spiritual orientation, but it is this this deeper fundamental stance that we take toward life that, you know, doesn't require a specific religious affiliation to be able to engage in.
Well, speaking of attitude towards life, there are many people, myself included, when they or a loved one faces death, they become grateful for life. And in my case, this gratitude feels permanent to me, this kind of gratitude for life. I mean, I went into my shower this morning, and, you know, I live in, you know, Jersey, and it's cold, you know, and there's... And my lawn was frozen, and I went into my shower, and the bathroom was warm. And I felt gratitude for the contrast, that I could have warmth right there in the midst of all this cold. I don't know, in my case, if I ever could have gotten there, if I didn't face death and if my life didn't feel fragile to me. Can that be done any other way?
Well, I suspect not, in the sense of a deep sense of gratefulness. There's levels and layers to gratitude, you know, from the more superficial politeness aspect as an element of civility, saying thank you, which I don't mean to underestimate. I think it's very powerful in terms of societal cohesiveness. But yes, as a deeper fundamental orientation toward life, as a way of looking at life, I think it does require some maturity, some reflection, perhaps some contrast with deprivation or loss or adversity, where now it's replaced by a sense of appreciation. So what you perhaps once took for granted now is seen as special. And I think that is a very powerful way of eliciting a grateful approach to life.
Yeah, Paul Simon said, the way we look to a distant constellation that's dying in the corner of the sky, you know, when it flickers, then we know how valuable it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking of life and death, there are certain emotions that open one's heart to gratitude. And one of them that I talk about often is awe. Watching a rainbow, any other spectacular show of nature. I went to the our local aquarium with a six-month-old baby this Saturday, and I saw the fish, the aquarium, through this baby's eyes, and it was awe, and I experienced awe. Is that trainable?
Well, that's a great question. It does require, I think, going back to kind of a childlike sense of wonder, a sense of, wow, that this is special. And I think some of perhaps the foundational feelings for awe and gratitude are the same. And I would propose that this is a feeling of humility, a sense of relative smallness in the face of something that is greater, grander, more powerful, more expansive than the self. I think if that can be trained, now that begs the question of how do you train a person to be humbly dependent upon others upon nature so that you can really acknowledge the power of the world, of other human beings. That's another question, but I think, you know, humility perhaps is something that's foundational to both this experience of profound wonder or awe, as well as grateful acknowledgement of others.
Yeah, I want to criticize our colleagues, yours and mine, therapists, who often do just the opposite. You know, that the work is about making people bigger and feeling bigger. You know, I saw a man for consultation a couple of years ago, and he said, you know, I've been in therapy for a lot of years, and I still don't feel like I'm very important. And I said, well, you're not. You know, you're not a therapy failure. You're not really important in the broad scheme of things. So now what? And this man actually cried with relief. I mean, deep down, he knew that. You know, so I really think it would be helpful to rethink therapy and how we do it and what the goals really are.
Well, and when we get into the realm of some of these more spiritual, transcendent feelings like awe and humility and wonder and gratitude, it really goes against the dominant ethos in therapy, which is a psychology of control, teaching people to be more in control of their lives, of their minds, of their thoughts, of their emotions. And many times relinquishing control is the step toward, you know, greater fulfillment in life, toward greater flourishing. And gratitude is, I think, partly counterintuitive because it involves giving up control. It's an acceptance of that which is.
Well,
it's the realization that we have what we have right now is sufficient to be grateful for life.
Yeah, really, Robert, it's giving up the illusion of control anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Eric on the line. Eric,
hello.
Hi,
yeah.
Eric.
I have a thought, my experience, that maybe ties together, I think, many of the ideas that you're talking about, and that is raising a child with special needs. My wife and I have been raising a son who is 15 now, who has autism, and I think when he was born, you know, you take for granted the way life is going to go, and I think we were sort of average in our sense of gratitude. But when you experience special needs, you have a death, like the death of your expectations or hope, and you have humility in the sense of your lack of control, so you have to accept what is, and you have a lot of adversity and hard work in order to accomplish things. And as a result, if you are of the right persuasion and sort of go down the right road, you have a huge amount of gratitude and appreciation for every little thing that happens, and you see other parents, you know, their kids walk, or they take them to baseball, or they take them to school, and they go through their regular lives without even noticing the amazing things that their kids are doing. Whereas when you have a child with special needs, if you can take the right perspective on it, you come to appreciate all of the small things that just don't come easy for you and your family.
You know, Eric, my grandson is on the autism spectrum, so, you know, my daughter and I often go to meetings and conferences, and I go to many on my own, and what you are describing, I hear over and over and over again from parents of children with special needs. Robert, what's going on here? What are the dynamics?
Well, I think there's basically, you know, I think that the point is well made by Eric that when we have a situation like this, a long-term challenge, it does shatter a lot of our illusions of self-sufficiency, of control, those which get in the way of gratitude. Within gratitude, we have to become receivers, right? Part of being a grateful person is receiving a gift, and part of receiving a gift is realizing that we can't give the gift to ourselves. And so we become more dependent. We become less self-reliant. We realize that we must depend upon the goodness, the benevolence of others. And then we become surprised when, you know, when things occur that we didn't expect to have happen. We know surprise is a primary element of gratefulness. When we expect good things to happen, we expect perfect kids with perfect grades and perfect athletic performance. We set ourselves up for disappointment. We come to have a sense of entitlement. But when we lower our expectations, we're open ourselves up to the possibility of good things happening, that we can be surprised by outcomes this in and of itself can activate and sustain a sense of gratefulness.
I think it was the Buddha or one of his disciples that said very simply, expectations cause suffering, period. Just that simply. Any expectations of a good outcome or a bad outcome is going to cause suffering. And what I think, part of what I hear from Eric and so many others, is that when you're raising a child who's different, then you're not thinking about the future so much. You're just right there with that child, and you don't have an image of the future. Eric, thanks so much for your call.
And thank you.
And I wish you the best. Let's go to Mary. Mary, hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, I'm struggling with supporting a loved one that regularly has trouble expressing gratitude. Lots of complaining, not happy with a lot of outcomes. And if you really look at her life, it's not terrible. So how do I be supportive yet save myself a lot of frustration by being around a person like that?
Great question. I'm glad we have a gratitude expert here, so I can pass it off. Robert?
Well, it's very difficult. We know emotions are contagious, but they tend to be contagious usually in one direction. That is, the negative tends to wear off on the positive more so than the other way around. So you're hanging out with her, you're going to be more affected by her negative emotions seemingly than your positive emotions would affect her. So it's difficult to just through some, you know, association or spending time together to have a lot of influence. You know, I suggest there's specific steps that a person can take, him or herself, to develop gratefulness. And, you know, I would ask the degree to which, you know, she would be open to some of these ideas or thoughts. Perhaps could be, you know, generally suggested that there is a different way, that there are other options out there, that one can gain control over their emotional lives. You know, I think part of the propensity toward negativity is the feeling that I have no options. I feel helpless. I feel a sense of victimization. People say things like, well, you know, gratitude might be a good idea for you, and but, you know, you don't understand my situation. My circumstances are so difficult, so unfair. It doesn't make much sense for me to work very, very hard at practicing gratitude. And so, you know, I think people have to get to the realization that there is another way out, that they can identify these non-grateful automatic thoughts and eventually come to replace them with more gratitude-supportive thoughts, and that it not necessarily is an overnight process. It's not, I don't think that a light bulb goes on, but perhaps they start to make some substitution of grateful thoughts for ungrateful ones, realizing that perhaps I could find something right now to be grateful for. Maybe it's her friendship with you that she could be grateful for. And it might not necessarily shift her, again, on this set point of gratefulness, but it might propel her in the right direction.
I am also mindful of Mary and her frustration or whatever the emotion is, the sadness, anger, at your, you said family member, Mary?
Yes, and I find that I like to help out, and I've brought her to church. You know, I've asked her to write in a journal. I've asked her to seek a therapist. She's done that, but then, you know, tries to be on her own. You know, doesn't continue with it after there's been a benefit. I just want to sort of save myself and not build like a resentment.
Then what would that look like?
What's
the care that you need?
I don't know. I think I just need to recognize that this is the person, and that's it. You know, I just at first thought that, oh, maybe this person's in need. And then after so many years go by, I realize, well, maybe that's just the personality. It's not a request for help. But, you know, there isn't.
Yeah, well, I worry about you more mm-hmm. than her because, you know, Robert talked about a set point, and maybe she is relatively comfortable at that set point, but you're not. And I worry about you because, not in a global sense, but just in this interaction, because you are feeling distress and you don't know what you need. And I would like to see you have that answer for yourself before you visit with her next time. Right. And so please take care.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. I'm grateful if you would.
Okay.
All right. Bye-bye. We're going to have to take a short break. We'll come back with your calls. My guest is Robert Emmons, and he's an expert on gratitude, professor of psychology at UC Davis, and the author of Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happier, and it really does. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
A proud supporter of WHYY, BNY Mellon Wealth Management is dedicated to helping financially successful individuals and families protect and grow their wealth. Details at BNYMellonWealthManagement.com.
Next time on Day to Day, 3 years ago, big incentives fueled a surge in ethanol plants.
People said, boy, we need to invest to get these things built.
Then corn prices spiked, the financial crisis hit, gas prices plummeted, and those new ethanol producers?
When ethanol was not as attractive as it once was, then they were all kind of left holding the bag.
Is ethanol's future running on empty?
The party is over.
Next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, 10,000 Villages, a source for handcrafted, fairly traded gifts and home decor this holiday season. 10,000 Villages in Center City, Chestnut Hill, Ephrata, Exton, Media, and Satterton. Also in Greenville, Delaware. 10,000villages.com.
We're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your grateful host. That's what we're talking about with Robert Emmons. He's an expert on gratitude. He's a professor of psychology at UC Davis. Hey, Robert, I've got a pretty simple question. We, infants and toddlers, they just seem so delighted in everything. So where does that go? Told you it was a simple question. Let the record show the expert laughed. Do we know? Does it go away? Is it still in there somewhere?
Well, I think the capacity is still in there, but of course it gets overlaid by so much culture and so many other aspects that it gets hard to, to unpack it again later on in life. The most grateful people are still able to, I think, keep the sense of joy, wonder, which you talked about earlier, the sense of awe. People like the famous British writer G.K. Chesterton, never lost the sense of this amazement for life, that he never failed to be surprised by life. And we do get jaded. I mean, the emotional system is such that we adapt. The word is habituation. We get used to our blessings. Yeah. We get used to our circumstances, which can, serve us well, I guess, in difficult times, but during times of abundance and prosperity, these pleasures wear off, and so we need more and more of them to get the same sort of emotional response. Our emotional systems like newness. It likes novelty. And so part of gratitude, I think, is the ability to delay this adaptation, to continue to appreciate new and novel aspects of our situation.
We had a caller early in the show that referred to a 12-step program. One of the steps in the 12-step program begins with, I forget which ones, towards the end, having had a spiritual awakening, we promise. And the first time I read that step, I'm thinking, well, having a spiritual awakening, but then we go back to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then we wake up, and then we go back to sleep. And, that's the way we are, we humans. Let's go back to the phones. We've got Esther on the line.
Good morning. I'd like to ask your guest whether he seems to have observed any generational differences in the feeling of gratitude. I've lived a good long life, and I feel that I perhaps am most grateful for having been born during the Depression. At this point in my life, some of my friends label me a Pollyanna because I'm still grateful for the smallest things in life. And, of course, our generation did want the next generation to have what we didn't. And I just feel that I observe more of a sense of entitlement than I used to. I'd like to know what your guest feels about that.
Interesting. Great question, Esther. Robert?
That's a very good question. I think that also ties together some of the themes we've been discussing. Number one, the need for adversity or deprivation or some sort of a contrast. And I think going through times, difficult economic times such as the Depression, gives a person a sense of perspective, a sense of contrast, that you don't take things for granted. You realize how fragile things can be. You realize that you think life might be other than it actually is. So you are able to engage in these sorts of comparisons, thinking about life now versus how life was, or how bad life could be versus how life is now. So we compare ourselves to imagined outcomes and look at our life now. And doing so, we see lots of reasons to be grateful. If you haven't had this contrast, if you haven't been through times of adversity or loss or crisis or suffering, it's much more difficult to conjure up a sense of gratefulness for life.
Well, that's
one element.
That's another thing that we psychologists worry about with these overprotected children who aren't allowed to face adversity, that they're going to be less likely to experience gratitude in their life. Yes?
And I think that's a very realistic concern as well. And when we look at the age differences, some data has been collected across the lifespan, and we do find that younger individuals score lower on our measures of gratefulness than older individuals, particularly younger males. Younger males are among the least grateful individuals we've studied, and that older females are the most grateful persons we've studied. So they're both generational differences as well as gender differences, which are very interesting.
Kind of, yeah, interesting and worrisome. One of the groups you studied was adults with neuromuscular disease.
Yes. We wanted to extend some of our initial findings, which were people who were relatively healthy and free from physical conditions. And so I was able to collaborate with some colleagues here at the Medical Center at UC Davis, and they've been looking at for some time now at life quality in persons with neuromuscular disease. These are either congenital or adult onset diseases, which are things like, well, polio disease when it was around, and now it's post-polio for people who had polio when they were children, neuromuscular disease of all sorts, muscular dystrophies, muscular atrophies. Lou Gehrig's disease would, of course, be a very severe form of it.
So what were you looking for?
Well, we wanted to find out if by cultivating gratitude, by gratitude journaling, as we did in our other studies, this could really improve the quality of lives with people with neuromuscular disease who have a lot of pain, disability, suffering. A lot of them are quite isolated. They're unable to work. They live alone, or they have a caretaker. And so we really wanted to see if focusing on appreciation, gratitude, could have the same positive effects that we found in the people who were free of a physical disease. Basically, try to help them out.
And
we did find that it made a huge difference in their lives. In fact, we were surprised when I actually did interviews and asked them to talk about or to write about something in their lives for which they were profoundly grateful. I thought, well, some of them would say, well, you're crazy. I've never been grateful. I've got this terrible, you know, illness. It causes me a lot of pain. I've never been able to walk. But these were amongst the most grateful people we were able to study, far more so than our seemingly mentally and physically healthy college students.
Yeah, I mean, part of the reason I was interested in that because, I don't know if you're aware, I'm a quadriplegic, and my sense of gratitude has grown in the 30 years that I've been in a wheelchair. And you know, you talk about set points. My gratitude set point has really gone way beyond what my genetic predisposition would have. You know, my parents were wonderful, but they were cranky, neurotic, normal, regular parents. And
what would you attribute mostly your gratitude to?
Well, I think as the less I have, the more I face death, the more grateful I am for what remains, for things that I can carry with me forever. It's those I love, those who love me, for my breath, for the colors of trees, because I don't trust I'll see another season in the best possible way. So then this season's precious to me, and I'm grateful.
That's so interesting because some of the questions I've been asked recently is, can you be grateful during difficult economic times, during economic uncertainty, political change, and so on? You know, they go through the list of current world events and so on. So, well, what really matters for people's happiness and well-being are not these things. There are things which transcend time. There's relationships. There's people's faith, what people find most meaningful and valuable in life. And these are generally not the things that are being threatened now by economic circumstances. And so why shouldn't we still be able to cultivate gratefulness and joy and well-being? Because it depends on things which are far more lasting and enduring than these temporary circumstances.
Boy, is it ever. Tell me, has your set point changed since you've been working on this?
Well, I think it has. It depends on who you ask. If you ask my wife,
that's who I really want to. Yeah.
So how is it that you're this expert on gratitude, or so-called? You're like the least grateful person that I know, and I think she probably exaggerates a little bit there. But
I trust her.
The topic was perhaps my set point was somewhat on the low side, and I was trying to, this was an exercise in self-improvement, as much of psychology research actually is.
Yeah, and most of psychotherapy is, and we'll go beyond that. Most of what we say it because we need to hear it.
And it's difficult to, I think, one of the challenges of studying a topic that falls amongst the virtues is that you're always comparing yourself with an ideal state.
Yeah.
And so you inevitably come up short, whether it's happiness or generosity or forgiveness. It's, we look at the ideal. This is what would lead to optimal functioning or to flourishing in life. And we realize that we come up short.
So my final word to you, Robert, is thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us on today's show. And please take care of yourself.
Thank you, Dan. Same to you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. My guest today has been Robert Emmons. He's a professor of psychology at UC Davis. He's done extensive research on gratitude. He's the author of Thanks, How Practicing Gratitude Can Make You Happier, as well as the psychology of gratitude. Next week, we'll be talking about compulsive shopping and what that means to us. Well, if you want to reach us, we're at voices@whyy.org. And you can reach me directly at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Kevin Griffin. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is the executive producer of radio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott's our executive producer. Voices in the Family is co-produced by Gita Simons and Elisa Walters. Me, I'm Dan Gottlieb, and I'm happy. Day to-